Minnesota Court of Appeals is now back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Brian, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 14, 2021. We are here for our third case on our calendar this morning, A210482, Commissioner of Morrison County Board of Adjustment versus Moore. Counsel, I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone when you are not speaking. Marshall is showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to that clock. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Jason Kubuschek representing Morrison County. This case involves the county's denial of an after-the-fact variance request on a property located on Fish Trap Lake in Morrison County. In particular, the zoning ordinance applicable to the Moore's requested variance first is section 706.1, which requires a 75-foot setback from the general development lake, which Fish Trap Lake is, and also 706.1A, which talks about the shore impact zone. The zoning ordinance established no structures can be placed in the shore impact zone. In this particular case, the Moores requested a setback, after the fact, variance for the setback for a deck located on the east or lake side of their cabin. The county denied the variance. The Moores appealed it, and the district court improperly injected its own will and findings in reversing the county's denial. Clearly, the county and the court, district court, looked at different things with regard to this variance. The district court was focused on the impervious surface, while the county's denial of the variance focused upon the setback request. The impervious surface issue here is not material, but rather it's the setback from Fish Trap Lake that is the material part of this variance. This court on variance appeals reviews them de novo and looks to whether or not the county's reasons are legally insufficient or not supported by any factual basis. Even though the county is the party appealing this matter to the Court of Appeals, the burden still falls on the Moores to prove that they meet each of the criteria. They had that burden at the Board of Adjustment proceeding, and they have that burden again, challenging that. Just a bit of background. This property is unique. You had an initial cabin built in 1935, 30 feet from the lake. This was prior to the county adopting a zoning ordinance. It would clearly be within the 75-foot setback from this lake, but because it came in place before the zoning ordinance, it is deemed a legal non-conforming use. So that original portion of the cabin is a legal non-conforming use. In 1977, the prior owner came into the county, requested a variance to build a deck on the north side of the cabin. So not on the lakeside, but on the north side of the cabin. It was to be a 16-by-16-foot deck and was not going to extend any closer to the lake than the cabin. That variance was granted. However, what that property owner built was not in conjunction with the variance granted. Rather, they built a deck that was on the north side, but also wrapped around onto the front side or the east and lake side of the lake. That part was not permitted. However, it was not caught by the county. And the county fully admits there'd been numerous visits to the property over time. They didn't recognize the lake side portion of the deck was illegal until we had the situation where the Moores came in. They bought the property. 2016, they requested a permit to work on the original cabin and to repair and replace the deck, including the east side. They did that, although all evidence shows they made that deck bigger. It's out of different materials and it's bigger. And at that point, the county got complaints from neighbors. They were wondering what's going on. How's this deck extending closer to the lake? It's at that point the county researched its files and went back and found that this east side or lakeside deck was never permitted. It was an illegal deck to begin with. The county did work with the Moores on other zoning violations. But with respect to this particular issue, the lakeside deck, the Moores wanted the after the fact variance to keep the deck they installed.
And so, counsel, one of the things that is concerning to me is that all of the history of potential deviations from what is accepted was part of the hearing as to whether the variance in this particular case should be the after the fact variance should be granted. And it seems as though there was a lot of piling on of non-conforming, historical non-conforming use, which was not at issue in this particular hearing. That was part of the hearing before the county. And so the question then becomes is, does that render the decision by the county unreasonable? Because it was based not only on the variance, the after the fact variance request, but also on this extensive history of, I didn't catch this violation, or they've been violating it for, you know, three decades or whatever.
Your Honor, with respect to that, there's no doubt there was significant historical information presented at this hearing. But I think that was necessary because of this non-conforming status. The Board of Adjustment really need to know what was going on. What was a legal non-conforming use, and what was an illegal non-conforming use? And I think that was very important. But also, even if you put that aside, there was evidence presented and directly on this. And I note it's at the Addendum 95 or Administrative Record 17. And I think this photograph very clearly shows and was presented to the Board of Adjustment the expansion of the deck towards the lake. It's got a line that shows the new concrete deck going towards the lake, and it shows how much further than the original deck it extended. And at the bottom of that page, it shows the original deck from 2016, which was a wooden deck, and it shows the steps going down to the lake. So we did have evidence in the record. We also have evidence in there at Addendum 105, Administrative Record 45, where the Moores submitted, and this gets back to the square footage, but they submitted what the square footage of the new deck is versus the old deck plus the steps. So the board had evidence in it that wasn't necessarily piling on, but related directly to this variance. So I think the historical information is important, but that aside, there was still plenty of evidence in the record to show this deck expanded towards the lake.
If I could jump in, because I heard Judge Frisch's question to be a different question than what it sounds like you answered. I heard her asking, and obviously, if I'm incorrect, Judge Frisch, please correct me. I heard the question is the board unreasonable in making its decision? Because it made its decision potentially on the basis of all of this historical evidence, when the actual variance requested is not about any of the stuff that happened with previous owners or the expansion or whatever in 1935, right? None of that was relevant to the issue that the board was deciding. So if they decide the issue before it based on something that's in the record but shouldn't have been, I think that's, and I'll just defer to Judge Frisch to clean up what I just spewed out there.
That's my question. It's because of our standard of review.
Right. And I understand. And the standard of review is, was it reasonable? Was it arbitrary, capricious? So is it unreasonable to consider historical data? It's necessary in this case because we're dealing with the 75 foot setback from the lake. And so there has to be an explanation of how did all of this get within that 75 foot setback? How did the cabin get within it? How did the deck to the north get within it? And then what is the history of the prior wooden deck on the lake side of the cabin? So that is all necessary to explain the historical background of this. And it is tied to it in that it's proper to consider the history of the property. You know, the board needs to know, why aren't we dealing with the variance for the cabin? Why aren't we dealing with the variance for the north? And so staff has to explain that to the board. So it doesn't make the decision unreasonable, especially when we've got the evidence specifically to the new deck and showing how it intrudes into the setback towards the lake. As I stated before, the burden falls on the moors to show that they met all the criteria. And they didn't do that. And in fact, the moors fully admitted at the hearing, look, we admit we went closer to the lake. You know, we went much closer to the lake, but we felt we were working within the spirit of the permit. But then you go into the legal criteria, and I think this is an area where the moors and the county differ. The moors in their brief argue that because it's an after-the-fact variance, you should only go through the Stadsfold and Kenny factors. But that is not how this court has interpreted that. Following the Stadsfold decision, following the legislature's amendment of the statutory variance standards, which the county ordinance mimics. Rather, the county is obligated to follow its ordinance requirements, to follow the statutory arguments, and go through the various elements. And that includes whether or not...
Let me just, if I could jump in. For the moment, right, let's assume that what Stratsville calls the equitable factors from Kenny, let's assume that those are applicable to after-the-fact variances at the time that Kenny and Stratsville are decided. After that happens, as you alluded to, there's the amendment to the statute that sets forth other specific factors. So what, if anything, should survive if those two lists of factors are not identical?
When the legislature amended the variance statute, they set forth the criteria to be followed, and the county recognized that, amended its ordinance. But the county ordinance also puts in that if those factors are met, so if they're able to prove up those variance factors, the Board of Adjustment may consider the other criteria laid out by Stadsfold. So they have that in their zoning ordinance that they can proceed on with that. So it's not that those factors completely went away, but the court in Stadsfold said, you know, you should consider this. And so what Morrison County did is they added that to their ordinance saying, you know, if we get past the statutory requirements for a variance, we should also consider this these factors as alluded to by the Stadsfold court.
But as a legal matter, if you have, let's say, five factors set forth in an opinion from the state Supreme Court about how you define or consider practical difficulty, right? And then you have the legislature that comes in and says, here are five different factors, or here are three factors, and they only take three from the Supreme Court's decision and codify that in the statute. What effect, as a legal matter, does the legislative decision on that same issue of what you consider to determine practical difficulty have on the Supreme Court's list? Not what does Morrison County include in its ordinance, but just as a legal matter, the act of amending the statute to include a list of factors to determine practical difficulty, what effect does that have on the Supreme Court's determination of factors that courts should look at prior to the amendment?
Yeah, I would say, Your Honor, that when the legislature amended the statute and set forth the specific requirements of the variance, that is what the applicants and the counties have to follow with respect to a variance application. The Supreme Court clearly laid out what they clarified the practical difficulties, because at the time we had the undue hardship standard in the statute, and the legislature took Stadsfold and changed how practical difficulties are defined. And that is the new standard which the counties and the applicants have to follow with regard to variances. Now, the additional after-the-fact criteria that Stadsfold talked about and said counties should consider, you know, in this case, Morrison County added those in additionally, saying if we get past these new statutory requirements, we do have these additional after-the-fact criteria which may be considered. So they certainly adopted it to a degree. In this particular case, we're looking at addendum 1 through 7, which is the denial of the variance packet with the county's findings and conclusions. we have findings in here supported by the evidence showing why the after the fact variance should be denied. And I can go through each of them, but I just want to point out some of the obvious ones here, and that the Board of Adjustment, one of the criteria is the variance is not created by the actions other than the landowner or prior landowners. Here, this criteria weighs heavily against the Moores because they specifically chose to replace the deck in a different design. They didn't replace it the same way. They chose to replace it in a different design and to bring it closer to the lake. Circumstances unique to the property. Again, here, this was on the Moores. They came in and requested a permit for the exact replacement. What they did instead was to move it closer to the lake. Now, we can hear about the impervious surface, but ultimately this is a setback from the lake requirement, which they further impinged upon.
All right, counsel, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Erickson.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christine Erickson, here on behalf of respondents James and Jill Moore. I'm going to jump right in and talk about the issue that Mr. Kubitschek just finished with, talking about whether or not my clients exceeded the scope of their permit. That seemed to be what the board relied upon, and it seems to be what the county relied upon in their brief. It's interesting to note that my clients went in when they first bought the cabin, decking on all three sides, and asked the county what they needed to do. The county said, fill out an application for a permit. They asked about drawing the sketch. He said, don't worry about the exact measurements. An approximation will be fine. They put an approximation, and now, after the permit is issued based on a site visit by county staff, it's the application that they continue to hang their hat on. The application said, same size as is. When the permit was issued, it never had that. The permit was issued with the facts. Replace the front portion of the cabin and a 20 by 12 foot deck, 240 square feet, and it noted that it would be 20 feet from the ordinary high water mark. That's what's on the permit. It's not reasonable to expect if they were going to hire a contractor, they don't show them the application for the permit and say, build my deck within the scope and the parameters. It's the permit that they relied upon. They handed that to the contractor, and the contractor then built the deck. Also, interestingly, the facts show, I think Mr. Kubitschek said that the facts show in the evidence that they expanded from what had been there. You look at the picture, he called it a concrete deck. It is not concrete. The deck makes it look that way. It's some kind of a plastic decking. At any rate, saying it went further, encroached further than anything in history is simply not true. We can see from the other historical pictures that the decking started out in front. It was looks like to be approximately 7 feet, with then a landing of approximately 3 feet and continuing all the way down to those water's edge since at least.
Is it your argument to this court now, Ms. Erickson, that the stairs going to the lake are actually a part of the deck?
I don't know that the stairs going down were. The last part kind of looks like a dock, but there is a landing that the deck looked like it to be about three levels to begin with. And one portion kind of looks like a landing in a kind of funky shape in between the trees. That they assumed was also part of the deck. And when they built that new addition, if you look at the angle of that, at best, there's a 3 feet addition on the south side little chunk that they would have expanded by. But it's also interesting, you know, when I say expanded by, remember the permit gives them 12 by 20. They built 10 by 18.6. The permit gives them 240 square feet. They built 207. So, you know,
so I guess if I could go back to the description of the original dock that you just gave us as including multiple levels and there being a landing. If I'm looking at the document with the two pictures correctly, where you've got figure 6 and figure 7. This is in the addendum, I think page 53, and you see where the trees are, and the deck ends at one of the trees.
Correct.
That's also where if you want to think of it as a landing, that's also where that landing would end. But the new deck goes further than that because it's reconfigured. And so I guess the question is, are you saying today now that the part of the old deck that was, I'll call it the first stair, beyond the tree line, right? Beyond that area where the tree is. Are you saying that is part of a deck and not part of stairs going to the water?
That is certainly the way my clients viewed it when they went in for the application. And Your Honor, just to clarify, the new deck does not expand beyond that last tree. It stays within it.
No, I don't know what you mean by the last tree, because when I look at figure 7, there are 4 trees there.
It'd be the one closest to you. You can see that now what they did is they put the decking up at the level of the doorway, and the stairs now go off the side rather than it used to come off the front. Yep. But now the deck stopped and it actually jogs out. So it comes in, it's only 7 feet on the north edge of the deck. Then it jogs out 3 more feet and then comes over to square it off.
I understand. Thank you.
Yes. So the other issue that was being discussed here was whether or not the board followed the ordinance when they were determining the criteria of whether a practical difficulty existed. And it starts out, we've got the statute, Minnesota Statute 394.27, subdivision 7. Yes, I agree. It states that variances shall only be permitted when in harmony with the general purpose and intent of official control, and they may be granted when they establish practical difficulty. It's my opinion that when they changed this statute after the Stadsfield decision, that what they managed to do was define what is practical difficulty. They defined practical difficulty as proposing to use it in a reasonable manner, the plight of the landowner being unique to the property and not created by the landowner, and if granted, will not affect and alter the essential character. But case law then, Stadsfield and Kinney, are the ones that then tell us, how do we determine whether or not these facts as applied to that definition fit? The factors are still relevant even after the amendment to that statute. It looks like I've confused you on that one. So let's go to the ordinance. Ordinance 506.2, Morrison County's ordinance. It states very clearly the board must find each of the following conditions are met. Then it goes through factors A through F, which come straight from the statute. There's a line in the center saying additional considerations for after the fact. And then it has additional factors G through N. That's it. That's all 506.2 says. So if the board was to follow the ordinance and find the relevant provisions, they would have asked all of those questions. Then 506.3 turns around and contradicts 506.2. It eliminates A through F and it says, gee, we're going to go ahead and let the board have an option of considering those additional after-the-fact variances. And they only have to do that if they can already meet A through F. That's not reasonable. There would be never a case that would get to the additional after the fact criteria. The purpose in that, the reason the court decided that was when you've got a situation like the Moores have, it's already been built. This deck's been in existence for 5 years, this new one. This particular case is just ripe for an after-the-fact variance in considering those factors. Without considering them, it's unfair, unjust. So that's why we need to go through all of them to determine, have we met that practical difficulty standard? To say, then I think Mr. Kubitschek also liked to mention that the first portion of the statute says you must find the first criteria question, whether it's in harmony with the purpose and intent of the comprehensive plan and the ordinance before going on to the next. I don't know that that's quite the way that that was intended either. If that was the case, you could stop right there. When you found out that, no, it didn't meet that, then we don't even need to go to the practical difficulties. I don't believe that's the intent of the statute. I believe the intent of the statute is, let's take all of these factors, consider all of them to help us determine whether or not we have managed to meet the burden of showing that it is within the intent of the ordinance and the plan. So then let's back up to the plan for a quick second. Impervious surface versus encroaching on the lake. We seem to have a struggle on which one of them is most important. And I don't believe either one of them is more important than the other. There is only one place where that is actually listed. And in that particular spot, it says, we encourage residents, this is in the Morrison County Land Use Plan, minimize the impact of surface runoff by establishing vegetative buffers and minimizing impervious surface. Once again, the Moors have decreased impervious surface. If they were, and I think this is where the district court determined that the board's decision was unreasonable, is they still have that variance, which runs with the land. The Moors could build this deck of 16 by 16 off to the north side of their cabin. They would take away 207 square feet of decking off of the east side, build 256 square feet on the north side, 5 feet away, and put a landing to help them with ingress and egress. This is after they relied on a permit to renovate the cabin, putting their sliding door on the front to go to their deck. Had they known this before when they ripped apart the entire cabin, they would have put a sliding door on the north side, built their deck off to the side, and we wouldn't be here today. But because they went and they did the additional landscaping projects, were cited for violations, they were already on the naughty list for the county. When they went in front of the Board of Adjustments, there was bias in looking at this decision. And they did not get a fair shake.
Can you talk about that for a little for a moment, counsel? I mean, I did ask Mr. Kubitschek about sort of the parade of horribles that were presented to the board about all of the deviations from the ordinances over time. And I'm struggling to find the conclusion of bias, which is a pretty hefty lift for you. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah,
How are you getting there?
Yeah, there were two issues in front of the board that day. We had a 320 square foot patio of flagstone off to the south side of the cabin and this deck off to the front. Rather than separating these issues, they decided to combine them and go through the criteria questions as if they were one and the same. There were some very stark differences between the patio and the deck. They should have been treated separately right from the beginning. The deck, for instance, they attempted to comply. They received a permit. There were no complaints from neighbors over the 4 years that it existed prior to this. It went unnoticed for that long. It did not change the character. There had been a deck there before. So it all fit. The deck was different. The patio.
So is it your claim that the introduction of this testimony regarding the non-conforming patio is somehow indicative of bias?
Well, I don't think that that's the sole reason that they determined that this should be denied, but it certainly didn't help the Moors. Mm-hmm. It, from the beginning, when the staff report came out, they combined the two. They said, take a look at this. This is an application for an additional 527 square feet of impervious surface. So they're looking at the two of them combined, when if we looked at just the deck and talked about the differences in the history of it, it should have been treated very differently. Like I said, the deck or the patio had no permit. They hadn't attempted to comply with it. It did increase the impervious surface. So to deny the patio made sense. But to treat them the same does not.
So I'm hearing you say, I mean, to put it within the context of our standard of review, that the decision of the board was unreasonable because it combined evidence, had nothing to do with the after the fact variance that was at issue with that issue as well. Can you point us to any authority at all that sort of gives us a baseline for determining when the decision of the board is unreasonable in that context?
You know, there were a couple different cases, both in the Minnesota, you know, it hasn't gone back to the Supreme Court in many of these decisions, but the Court of Appeals, or in front of this court, we had Nesvik versus Crow Wing County, unpublished decision from 2011, Much versus the County of Hubbard, unpublished decision from 2012. Both of them made it certain that we had to go through and lay out the Stadsfield factors before going through, those were the criteria. That's long after the court case in Stadsfield. And I think that it was imperative that this board reach those same conclusions. I also want to quick squeeze in a remedy if I could. And the remedy in this case would be that the court go ahead and orders that the variance be granted. The only time a remand would be appropriate would be if the court found that the evidence in the record was not sufficient to establish their decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from the panel?
I do have an additional question as we're trying to explore this interplay between the statutory amendment and whether there's a distinction between after the fact and beforehand, and are there additional factors that would also apply if it was after the fact, or is it only those factors instead of what's in the statute? So my question for you, Ms. Erickson, is simply this. If a person is asking for an after the fact variance, but they cannot establish one of the statutory factors in subdivision 7, is the zoning board or committee still required to consider what you've identified as additional after the fact criteria not listed in the statute? Or is it if they can't meet the criteria in subdivision 7 for practical difficulty, full stop, that's all you need to look at?
No, I believe that's exactly on point. They need to address those after the fact criteria to help them determine whether or not a practical difficulty can be established. It's going to be an unfair result if we don't take into consideration the good faith. A lot of those after the fact criteria did come from Stadsfield. Stadsfield actually has 12 criteria questions, and to have the county narrowed it down.
Well, the legislature narrowed it down.
Well, right?
I mean, the legislature amended the statute post Stadsfield to list what it thought someone should look at when considering practical difficulty. And you're the one who just said this at the outset of your argument, that the legislature tried to define practical difficulty by listing those factors. There are some additional things not included in subdivision 7. And I understand your argument to be that when you're looking at after the fact, that's all you look at, that you don't consider what's listed in subdivision 7. And because the board considered what's in subdivision 7, that was the error according to the brief. And now I'm not sure that's your argument based on what you've told us, orally. It sounds like you're also saying something a little different. So I wanted to clarify, if someone is applying for an after-the-fact variance, but they cannot establish practical difficulty, factor number one under 394.27 subdivision 7, they just can't establish that. Does the zoning board have to consider anything that you've identified as the additional after-the-fact considerations, or is it enough that the person requesting the variance can't establish that first factor under subdivision 7?
I don't think that's enough to establish the first factor. And I believe that the factors from case law help determine whether or not we can meet the statutory definition of practical difficulties. That's where I think we parse the difference. I believe the factors are necessary in order to determine, have we met the statutory definition? So that's what I think the legislature changed when they amended the statute, is the defining of practical difficulty, not telling us how do we get there.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Mr. Kubitschek, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Hold on 1 second while we get the clock going. Go ahead, sir.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I just think we've had a lot of discussion regarding the statute and the variance elements under subdivision 7. And you know, the legislature made a specific change following Statsbold. And the county has to follow, they're a creature of statute, and they have to follow what's required in statute. And in order for the county to grant a variance, they have to follow the standard set forth in subdivision 7. And that is the only standard set forth that talk about what must be met to grant a variance. Now, the county has gone beyond that and said, we'll also consider Statsbold if you meet these requirements. But the county first has to show that these elements in subdivision 7 are met. And that's a statutory requirement. So to say we could skip over that and jump right to the Statsbold, the county doesn't have the authority under the statute to do that.
And so just what would be your response to the way Ms. Erickson has described what survives from Statsbold and Kenny after the amendment? Do you agree that what case law has provided is a list of factors that help us decide, I guess, for lack of a better word, a list of factors that help us decide the statutory factors? You've got case law factors to help you decide statutory factors, or do you conceive of this structure a little differently?
I think it's different, Your Honor. I think that, when Statsbold came out, again, we were dealing with an undue hardship standard in the statute. And then the practical difficulties came out. And so the court gave us direction of, here's how you define practical difficulties. The legislature had that decision before it and available to it when it redid and amended subdivision 7 and said, okay, we're going to drop undue hardship. We're going to go with practical difficulties, and here's how you define it. And those are the elements that the counties have to follow. That's how practical difficulties is defined. Statsbold has factors in there to consider when dealing with after the fact variances. They're not required. They say, the county should look at this. And that's why, again, Morrison County has that as you may consider those additional factors. But Statsbold, as far as how it defines practical difficulties, once the legislature amended the statute, the statutory definition controls. And I just heard that
if I could jump in again, Mr. Kubitschek, I'm sorry. Does the statute make any difference between beforehand and after the fact variance requests?
It doesn't. And that's why the county has to follow through with those elements for a variance, whether it's a beforehand or after the fact variance. The legislature didn't differentiate it. They just said for any variance, you have to go through with these factors. And that's what the county did in this scenario. I just want to briefly touch on this bias argument raised and the fact that they were put on the naughty list and therefore it's bias. I think when you look at an after the fact variance, they did something they weren't supposed to do. They've already done it. They've come in. So if the court were to find bias in this situation, just because the county's looking back at what they had done and what they had done that was in violation of the ordinance, you would find bias in any after the fact variance. So we don't think there's any evidence of bias in this record. Importantly, it wasn't even raised by the Moores during the hearing that they felt there was any bias, having these two variances heard together. They never raised the issue and said, we need you to separate them. It wasn't until we got to briefing that it's suddenly being raised. So we feel that the administrative record shows that there's legally sufficient reasons for the county's decision and that there's evidence to back up those reasons. So the county would request that the court would affirm the Board of Adjustments decision in denying the after the fact variance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.